WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nearly all of America's blunders in war and peace these past few years stem from a few grand ideas about American power and how the world changed after the Cold War and 9/11, ideas that proved to be false. That's the premise of the new book, Daydream Believers, How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power. It's about the misconceptions my guest Fred Kaplan says have guided American policy and led us into Iraq, and about the men who came up with those grand ideas. Kaplan writes a column of military analysis called War Stories for the online magazine Slate. His first book, The Wizards of Armageddon, was about the men who first developed America's nuclear weapons strategy. Kaplan reported from Washington, D.C. and Moscow for the Boston Globe and was part of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize for a Boston Globe magazine story on the U.S.-Soviet nuclear arms race. Fred Kaplan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
Let's talk first about the grand ideas, the grand theories that you write about in the book. The first is that everything changed after September 11th.
Right.
What's the theory?
Well, the theory was that we'd never experienced anything like this, and therefore the entire world has changed. You don't need to look at history anymore. You know, if you think back all the times during the Bush administration when people would try to look at the lessons of history when it came to, say, dealing with insurgencies or dealing with, say, the North Korean government or negotiating with adversaries, the attitude was always, well, that's in the past. That's old Europe. That's old thinking. We're in a new era now. And it gave them leave to just dismiss every lesson of history that went against the kinds of policies that they were endorsing and advocating.
Now, this dovetailed with another thing that you describe as a grand theory, which is that America emerged from the Cold War as the sole superpower.
Right. This is the paradox that I think a lot of people didn't and still don't understand. You know, the Cold War, I mean, it was a time of horror and depravity, but it was also a system of international security. You know, the world was basically divided into two spheres, and if you were a member of one sphere or the other, you went along with your superpower, at least to some degree, sometimes even sacrificing your own national interests in exchange for the security that was provided, or in the case of the Eastern Bloc, the oppression that was foisted on you. When the Soviet Union disappeared, just imploded in 1991, the common enemy, the Western Alliance's common enemy, also disappeared. Suddenly, a lot of countries realized that they could go their own way, that they could follow their own interests, regardless of what Washington felt about the matter. The main thing, though, is that in the past, there was this Western coalition. And sometimes various countries departed from it, but that was the default mode of international relations in the West. Once the common enemy disappeared, the default coalition also disappeared. If the United States wanted to retain its preeminence, it would have to go seeking alliances and coalitions, issue by issue, point by point. Diplomacy became a harder thing and a more vital thing. The Bush people came into power thinking that they were all eminent, that the United States was now practically an omnipotent power, that we didn't need alliances, that in fact alliances just sort of got in the way. And so, you know, forget about the ABM Treaty, forget about the Kyoto Treaty. After September 11th, and I think one of the most moving moments in transatlantic history, the other nations of NATO got together and said, we want to invoke Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. That's the article which says that if one country is attacked, the others come to their defense. This was designed for the United States to come to the defense of Europe in the event of a Soviet attack. And here we're now, the European allies, saying the United States is under attack and we want to come help you. And Bush just blew him off. Said, no, don't worry about it. We don't need this. You know, there were NATO meetings planned, conferences where we would work out a common approach toward terrorism. This was going to revitalize the alliance, and the Bush administration used it as a vehicle for rallying support for the Iraq War.
Okay, so let's just sum up some of the grand ideas you've mentioned so far. One, the world changed after September 11th. Two, the United States emerged from the Cold War as the only superpower, which leads to three, the United States could go it alone and didn't really need alliances anymore. And this connects to another grand idea that you discuss in your book, Daydream Believers, and that is that there is an ongoing revolution in military affairs. What is that revolution?
The idea is that we now have technology that substitutes for mass. If you have weapons that can be targeted to particular targets with extreme accuracy, if you have computers and surveillance systems that can get a complete picture of the battlefield, you can defeat armies with a very small force. And so you don't need large armies. You don't need allies going into military interventions with you. It can all be done with, from the air. Some people thought you didn't need armies at all. It could all be done with these wonder weapons fired from the air.
And so wars could be short and swift.
Short, swift, light. The whole idea of this, some of these weapons were designed at a time to overwhelm growing Soviet strength. After the Soviet Union disappeared, it was recognized, well, maybe this can be used as a tool to preserve American preeminence around the world. And the idea, the reason why Donald Rumsfeld, for example, wanted to go in to Iraq with a very light force. Remember, his generals were telling him you need 300,000 soldiers. He was saying, he pared it down. It was really a question that applied not just to Iraq. He wanted the Iraq War to be seen as a demonstration of American power, that even after the end of the Cold War, with a much smaller army, with no allies behind it, the United States could still work its will, could still change regimes that we don't like, practically with one hand tied behind our backs. And it was the revolution in military affairs that would allow us to do this.
And this was an idea that was also tested in 91 in the Gulf War.
Well, it started in the Gulf War. You know, the smart bombs, as they called them, were still a very small percentage. You know, of all the bombs that were dropped in the 91 war, only 9% of them were smart bombs. And a lot of them weren't that smart. They were still guided by lasers, and lasers could get diffracted by moisture and smoke and fog and dust. Now they had, though, by the time Afghanistan happened, they had these new kinds of weapons that were guided by GPS satellites. So all you had to have was the longitude and the latitude, and it would land right on the spot. And Afghanistan was sort of the turning point. You know, that there were times when these weapons would just come right in on their targets. Donald Rumsfeld took that as a redemption of transformation. Before Afghanistan went in, the Army was estimating that we would need to send two armored divisions in through Pakistan to overthrow the Taliban. Well, it turned out we did it with a handful of special ops forces and the smart bombs. So this had a significant effect when it came to Iraq planning. When the Army came in and said, okay, we're going to need 300,000 troops to defeat Iraq and to occupy it afterwards, Rumsfeld was thinking, well, you are way off on Afghanistan, and I have no reason to think that you're not still way off on Iraq. There was one thing, though. He forgot something about Afghanistan. You know, the Northern Alliance, with the help of U.S. support, was able to overthrow the Taliban government quite easily. But what he didn't realize was that, and now, of course, as we know, that the Taliban and al-Qaeda kept fighting. The war was not over. He made the mistake that many people who have forgotten their Clausewitz make, and that is that, you know, war is politics by other means, and the war is not over until you've accomplished the political objectives. It's one thing to destroy targets or even win battles. It's another thing to win a war. And you know, people say that both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, they won the war but lost the peace. I don't view it that way. They didn't even win the war. They forgot what the objective of the war was.
Well, Rumsfeld has been out for a while. So where does this theory of a revolution in military affairs stand now? Does Robert Gates believe in that? Do military commanders, current military commanders believe in that?
Well, I think there's a more realistic appreciation of its limits. I mean, I think Rumsfeld was right and the generals were wrong in terms of how many troops you need to simply defeat an army and overthrow a government. But what is now being appreciated is that's really the start of things. Unless you just want to leave the society in shambles, you have to impose order afterwards, or you have to create a situation where order can be imposed afterwards. And that's led to this renewed appreciation for the techniques of counterinsurgency, which is basically involving having a lot of troops, well-trained troops on the ground for a long, long time.
One of the technologies that was part of this idea of a revolution in military affairs was a missile defense, an impermeable defense that would prevent enemy missiles from penetrating the United States. In the Reagan era, that was the Star Wars technology. Mm-hmm. How hard has President Bush tried to keep the idea of missile defense alive?
Well, you know, it's funny. When he first came into power, that was his number one priority. He'd said this all through the campaign, that his number one priority was to junk the anti-ballistic missile treaty and to get a missile defense system going. This was another case, and maybe the most profound case, of the people coming into power not being familiar with history. If they'd been familiar with the history of missile defense, they would have seen that this story went back, I mean, not just to Reagan, it goes back to the mid-50s. I mean, it's a noble quest, it's a legitimate aim, but for technological reasons that have not changed and are not likely to change, this has just proven to be impossible. And it happens each time, about every decade, a president comes in saying, wow, this is really some new promising technology, let's get rid of this nuclear danger, and then they start to work on it, and they realize, oh, it has obstacles that are really insuperable. And the interesting thing is, for all the emphasis that Bush put on missile defense when he first came into power, by 2004, he's hardly said a word about missile defense ever since. Even though some interceptors have actually been deployed, he doesn't say anything about it, even though we continue to spend about $12 billion a year on it. You know, it's a great corporate boon. It's a technology boon. People still have hope in it, and therefore we spend, in the current budget, which Bush just released this week, he's asking for $12.5 billion, which is way more than for any single weapon system.
While we're talking about the perceived revolution in military technology, let me ask you about President Bush's new budget. He's proposing increasing military spending to its highest level since World War II, a $515.4 billion budget just for the military, and that doesn't include spending on the war in Iraq or the cost of nuclear weapons. And this is apparently 30% higher than when President Bush took office.
Yeah, if you add it all up, if you add in the cost of the nuclear weapons, the supplementals for the war, it really comes to about $713 billion.
What's it going toward? Like, what insights can you give us into the budget?
Well, the funny thing about the budget is that if you took somebody who fell asleep 20 years ago and woke him up now, and, you know, when the Cold War was still going on, and woke him up now and showed him the military budget, he wouldn't be surprised by anything. This is a budget that, again, except for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, is dominated by aircraft carriers, submarines, fighter jets, missile defense. For all the talk about transformation, good or bad or indifferent, the budget is one thing that has not been transformed at all.
Does that mean that they don't believe in the revolution anymore, or that they're just funding all the old weapon systems anyways?
Well, you know, a lot of the generals and admirals who really run the permanent Army, Air Force, and Navy never got off on this stuff to begin with. They saw it as an attack on their mainstream systems. You know, when you talk about we want to build an army that is light, that is easily deployable, rapidly deployable, then you're talking about an army that doesn't have heavy tanks. And that's still the mainstay of the mainstream army. So they've stuck it out. They've survived. In terms of what we're buying, what we're spending money on, And although this is changing a fair amount, but still what the soldiers and crewmen and so forth, airmen, are being trained on, it's still very much a military geared up to fight the Cold War.
My guest is Fred Kaplan. His new book is called Daydream Believers: How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fred Kaplan. His new book is called Daydream Believers: How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power. And we've talked about some of the grand ideas that you write about in your book. There's a blurb on the back of your book from Tom Ricks, the Washington Post military correspondent who wrote the book about the post-invasion of Iraq called Fiasco. And he writes in this blurb that the story is told by an author who knows where the secrets are kept, and also that the most powerful and dangerous weapon in Washington, D.C. is a new idea. How do you think that fits into what you're trying to do, the idea of a new idea being a powerful and dangerous weapon in Washington?
Yeah. New ideas, if it's an idea with potency, it shakes things up. I mean, when Rumsfeld put out these ideas, some of which were very interesting and some of which were complete nonsense, but he did it deliberately to shake things up. Bureaucracies are made of power centers. World politics is made up of power centers. And the last part of my book goes into this. The idea that President Bush tried to put out there, especially starting with his second inaugural address in 2004, was this idea that the centerpiece of United States foreign policy will be toppling tyrannies and making the world democratic. You know, the freedom agenda. And this, to me, was maybe the most disastrous idea that the United States has put out in the last several years. I mean, the idea, of course, is a beautiful idea. People should be free. But he had an interesting conception. He said, I believe that freedom is a gift from God. Now, the assumption of that, if you take that idea seriously and not just as a nice little bromide, and I think that he does take it seriously, it's that freedom is the default mode of humanity. That, you know, if you blow up the manhole cover that is a tyranny, freedom will gush forth like a geyser. The implication of that is that you don't have to do anything to make it gush forth. You just knock off the bad guy and the rest happens automatically.
Give us an example of what you mean about toppling the bad guy isn't good enough. You have to work to have freedom.
Well, for example, the elections in Iraq. President Bush seemed to think that once you held elections, that showed that democracy was in action. And you remember the first elections in Iraq. I mean, they truly were inspiring activities. You know, these shots of the women coming out of the voting booths with their purple-stained thumbs. I mean, this was incredibly moving. But it didn't mean the beginning of democracy. As it turned out, all the Shiites voted for religious Shiite parties, the Sunnis voted for Sunni parties, and the Kurds voted in a referendum to secede from the government. Those elections, in fact, politicized social divisions that had gone back decades and even centuries. So just because you have an election, that doesn't mean that everybody has decided to settle down. You need to have democratic institutions which are able to mediate differences and settle disputes in ways that don't inspire rancorous violence. And that is what these places don't have. And this was what was just not understood as being a necessary precondition for true democracy.
Now, you said that the next president has to rebuild alliances. How difficult do you think that would be to do?
Well, it's actually going to be a lot harder than people who say they favor building up alliances think it is, I think. It can't be done just by piecemeal. You know, the other countries of the world have now had a taste of going out on their own, pursuing their own interests, quite apart from any consideration for how it affects Washington, how it affects international politics, but as somebody else sees it. China has risen, you know, you have India as a factor. And so alliances can't just be something that you pay lip service to. There's actually going to have to be compromises. In other words, if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama are the next president and the world rejoices, as I think they will, but you can't just go pay them a call, say, okay, it's the year 2000 again, it's the year 1990 again, We're going to be setting the policies just like we always did, but don't worry, we're going to be consulting. You can tell us what you think about it. No, it's not going to be like that anymore. We have different interests. I mean, sometimes they coincide, sometimes they converge, but on some things they differ. And if we want to create coalitions for whatever purpose, if we want to create alliances, they have to be truly common alliances. And on some things, we are going to have to compromise. The United States is going to be in a position that we've never been in all the years that we were an actor on the global stage, you know, since World War II, an explicit, active, persistent actor. We have always been the ones in charge. I'm not suggesting that we are in decline. I mean, the United States is still the only country with truly global reach politically, economically, and militarily. However, that's not the basis of power. You translate these raw materials into influence, into creating scenarios, into setting up agendas. And we are not the only powers in the world right now. And it's going to be very hard to create some of these alliances. It's going to be very frustrating. However, the alternative is increasing isolation and persistent defeat. If the America is not to be a declining power, then we are going to have to make compromises and make our way in a world that we don't really control everything in. And that is going to be very difficult.
Fred Kaplan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Fred Kaplan is the author of the new book, Daydream Believers, How a Few Grand Ideas Wrecked American Power. He also writes the War Stories column for the online magazine Slate. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.